Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on The Front Porch. Today we're going to talk about McDowell County. Is hope alive there? Should it be? We speak with a former newspaper reporter from Bluefield whose essay on McDowell County created quite a response, including a response from former First Lady Gail Manchin. And we talk with our guest, Michelle Baranaskis, coordinator of Partners in Community Outreach. We're going to ask about home visiting. What is it? And if it's so effective, why don't we do more of it? Joining me, as always, is Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And our co-host, Lori Lynn, is in
She had to return her books to the Reagan Library, Scott, so she can't be with us this week.
Okay. I heard that she was in the inferior Virginia, the old Virginia, this week visiting family. So we'll...
Conflicting reports on that one.
We'll have to ask her when she gets back. We're speaking with Garrett Matthews. He is a former editor and columnist at the Bluefield paper. Went on to become a columnist at the Evansville, Indiana newspaper, now retired. And Garrett, you caused a great deal of controversy when you wrote your op-ed about McDowell County and what you saw there after being gone for several decades. In your piece, you talk about leaving the region in 1987, and McDowell County, of course, was already starting its long, slow decline. What brought you back to McDowell County, and what did you see?
I'm doing some volunteer work in the area. I found a host who sort of took me around and showed me some of the places and talked a little bit about what was going on. And it was sad. But the thing that was really new with me coming back was were all the drugs. If there was a meth and OxyContin problem in the mid-80s, I didn't know about it. And that's what's worsened. And it's from just a lack of hope. The job situation is bad. And you can almost understand the problem in some ways, because if you just wake up day after day with no hope and no job, and it's easy to sink into despair. And sadly, I think that's what's, you know, a lot of people in southern West Virginia have fallen into that.
You've talked about a host, a person that was driving you around war and showing you things and telling you what was going on. And this person has asked you to remain anonymous, but also has some really deep and intimate knowledge of what's going on there because of the position this person holds.
Right.
And so you're hearing some horrible things. This person was talking about children being sold for drugs.
Maybe I knew in the back of my mind that it had gotten really bad, but I guess you don't want to see it, because, you know, you go over to McDowell County in April when the red bud comes out, and then you're there in the fall in October when all the trees are turning. You know, you can almost forget sometimes, but the fact of the matter is, you know, you had a county that was very dependent upon coal, and when the hand loading and stuff like that sort of faded out in the 50s, you just had a gradual decline. You had 100,000 people in McDowell County in the early 1950s, and now you're down to 21 or 22,000, and it's just a sad, just sort of diminishment of a county. And I wish there was something, like I put in the piece, I wish there was something I could say, some pixie dust or something that I could rub or spread and everything would be better.
You know, another structural thing that hit McDowell hard was the collapse of the domestic steel industry, because a lot of those were sort of, they used to call them captive mines that produced directly for...
Right, U.S. Steel, and the decline of U.S. Steel in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, Gary was a company town, and I think it was 70 or 71 when U.S. Steel pulled out and all the company homes were sold.
So former First Lady Gail Manchin, who also was formerly the chairwoman of our state school board and leading this nonprofit group called Reconnecting McDowell, which is an effort to help McDowell County in lots of different ways. She took some umbrage to your article and its tone, and here's what she said.
It made me very sad on the one hand, and then it made me angry. So I had a mix of feelings, and then came to the reality that someone just passing through, that would maybe still be your reaction. And so I wanted my response to be not angry or sad, but a reality check about what really is going on in McDowell County. Much of what you can't see, and some of what hopefully in the near future you will see.
I don't want to say that there's not any hope. That's not a good thing to say. There's always hope, I think, that something can happen. But it just, and this is just an opinion of mine. And, you know, I have been back to McDowell County. I grew up in Abingdon, and when I would go visit family, sometimes I would come into West Virginia, and I would spend a day and drive around Beckley and Mullins and Pineville, some of the places that I used to go to write stories.
My wife, for several years, was an educator in McDowell County, foreign language, and spends a lot of time down there. One thing that she says, she's done it all over the state, but she really liked McDowell best because actually the parents were more heavily engaged in their kids' education. There was more enthusiasm. And I do think there are a lot of efforts going on in McDowell. The drug thing that you mentioned, I think it's been documented that drug companies aggressively marketed to Southern West Virginia. There have been some lawsuits about that. I mean, it's still a controversial thing. So
part of the issue is we get our backs up, and rightfully so, when anybody criticizes us. You know, and a lot of times the criticism isn't fair. It's always unpleasant. And yet, on the other hand, Garrett, I mean, you're a newspaper man. Your life is devoted to journalism. You know, is there a case to be made that we have to be reminded of how bad a situation is sometimes?
I wrote, you know, what I saw. I was sad that the place that where I sort of considered that I kind of learned to write by finding people over there and who had such colorful stories that even if I've screwed it up, it was still going to be pretty interesting because of just the folks that I was talking to. So there's just deep feelings that I have for McDowell, Mercer, Wyoming counties because it's where I learned my craft. And I just wrote an honest thing about when, you know, going around and seeing what I saw and hearing what I heard, and I was saddened by it. And I don't want to give the impression that it is hopeless. It isn't hopeless. There's always, as long as we're living, there's hope. And
I think there is, you know, it's not all bad all the time, but we can't deny the tragic side. I'm thinking about someone I had the privilege to meet a few times, Tom Hatcher, who was mayor of War.
You know, I knew him back in the day, and of course, that's a sign that people just use of the drug culture. The fact that his death was related to that.
Yeah, he was killed by a relative in 2012, and it's a real sad story. He was someone who really heavily involved in his community. I talked to him, you know, in the late 2000s, and he was hopeful about the things that were going on in McDowell, and felt like they were. People had heart there, and they kind of were going to turn a corner. So I was really saddened when I heard that story. One thing, my personal reaction when I read your column is I know you called for, like, charities to coordinate their efforts, right?
That's one, yeah.
So part of me thing, I always tend to think, like, there's charity, but then there's justice. And, this is an area from which so much wealth has been extracted at such a terrible human cost. I don't just mean McDowell, but the surrounding counties. That's why I think we really need good federal and state policies to help undo the damage to these communities and to the people who live there.
Garrett, what then do you say besides, you know, Rick wants justice, you are asking for charity. I have to wonder whether what we really need is palliative care for the county. In other words, helping children to grow up healthy, strong, and leave, and then helping the people that remain there to have a safe and healthy, you know, life in retirement. But understanding that here we are, we're 50, 60, 70 years into this experiment. McDowell County has gone from 100,000 population to about 18,000 today, and it doesn't look like it's stopping. Are we kind of silly to keep trying to say, you know, let's save this place, let's bring it back?
I don't think it's silly because I think what you've got, the people who are staying, they're very determined. They've had 30 or 40 years to maybe reflect on this, maybe weigh the pros and cons of leaving. And I think this core group has waited, and they, for whatever reason, family, or they have hope or whatever, but they've decided to stay. So I think you can't just close the county down and move everybody. I think what you've got is a core group who are going to stay, and they're going to tough it out, and they have faith and belief that maybe something will happen. And like I say, maybe it is. I think the hope is that internet and maybe something, you've got some ATV stuff going on. I know in Bramble has got some cabins and things. You've got some of these ATV trails. Maybe the outdoors you know, in Fayette County, when you had the whitewater stuff came in the late 60s and early 70s, maybe there's something, you know, I'm not an ATV person, but maybe there's that kind of thing that can turn it around, because obviously there are a lot of places in Medell County that are very wild and very wonderful, and maybe that's maybe one of the answers to it. I don't know.
Well, you know, I go all over West Virginia, and I don't think I've been any place that has as much heart as McDowell County. So, I don't think we can write McDowell off. I think it can really turn around. I don't know if it's going to be Manhattan or if it's going to be Fayetteville, but it's going to be more of itself, I think.
I always thought that a way to do something in McDowell County was to preserve a coal camp town.
Yeah.
Maybe take a you know, one of the hollows, Ashland maybe, or somewhere down in there, and preserve the coal camp, and just like what Pocahontas was trying to do for a long time, to preserve an Appalachian town and let it go back to the heyday. And you know, Beckley's got its exhibition coal mine, and I always thought there was the potential in McDowell County to try to preserve some of these structures that are still standing, prop them up, and have a history lesson, have a living history lesson of this is what, in the golden age of mining coal, this is the way people lived, and this is how they got by.
You know, one other policy thing that I think is still in play right now is something that's called the Reclaim Act that's been introduced with bipartisan support, including West Virginia Congressman Evan Jenkins and some Democrats from Kentucky, which would actually free up some of that abandoned mine lands money to bring it to places like McDowell County to put people back to work, undoing some of the damage. And I'd like to see there be more support of that act in both houses of Congress. You know, that would be a step toward justice for the coal fields.
Garrett, you get the last word here. Is there anything else that you want to get across?
Just that I'm not a carpetbagger. I lived there for a long time, and I've been back a lot. And I do feel like I know the area pretty well. I've interviewed hundreds of people in the 70s and 80s who were McDowell County folks. Jennings Boyd and Mr. Moore, the supervisor, or the county commissioner, and Ronnie McKenzie goes back a long way. And so, I, you know, whatever criticism you take, I accept it. Ms. Manchin, she's a wonderful person, and she has her opinion, and I guess I have mine, and there we go.
Garrett Matthews is a retired columnist from the Evansville, Indiana paper, and former editor, reporter, columnist in the Bluefield Daily Telegraph.
Who worked with my dad.
Who worked with your dad?
He worked with my dad, who was kind of a wild man of gonzo hillbilly journalism.
Yeah, I remember that there was the all-day slayings. There was this family from Georgia who were brutally slain, and the bad guys came up to McDowell County to hide out, and Dee was out on the story, and I was on the desk that night. And he told me to say, I was intimidated. I was 22 years old, and I thought Dee was this big stud of a guy who had done all the civil rights. He told me to leave the front page open, and he'd have these guys, and I'm sitting there sweating bullets. It's 8, 9, 10 o'clock, and finally Dee comes back, and they didn't catch him. And I had to run a picture of this dog taking Prince the Wonder Dog was trying to track him, and he failed. And so to fill up the page, I ran a couple of pictures of the dog, and I think one of them, the dog was pissing. But because Dee had said, you know, they're going to catch these guys tonight. Leave me a lot of the front page. So, he was a big man, and I wasn't, so I left him about half the front page. He came back with an 8-inch story that they didn't get caught. Two or three pictures of Prince, the Wonder Dog. I will never forget that. That was in 73 or 74, and they made him the crime reporter. He had a pretty... He didn't have to come in and do 8-hour shifts. He was a police reporter, and he would come and go as he pleased, and he had a police scanner and revolver. Dee would bring his holster up to work. And I looking back, I think they were live rounds. And
yeah,
he would
probably
throw that holster down on the desk. Hell, that damn thing could have gone off, you know.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we speak with our guest, Michelle Baranaskis. We're going to talk to her about home visiting in West Virginia. These are programs that help parents learn how to be better at their jobs, especially with young children. But first, I want to take a moment to thank our 10,000-plus members. Your gift allows us to tell West Virginia's true story and keep hope alive across our beautiful state. If you're not a member yet, or you need to renew your membership, join us now and help us reach our goal in the Countdown to June 30th campaign. Call 1-800-RADIO-87 or pledge at any amount at wvpublic.org. Okay, we're back, and we're speaking with Michelle Baranaskis. She's the coordinator of Partners in Community Outreach. It's a group that does coordination of different home visiting programs in West Virginia. Michelle, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it. In a nutshell, for people who have no idea what we mean by a home visiting program, what is it?
Home visiting is where trained providers go into people's homes at their invitation and help them with parenting education and support. They do some developmental screenings. They teach them about early brain development and help them be the best parents they can be. I work with the Healthy Families America program, the Maternal Infant Health Outreach programs, and Parents as Teachers programs. In addition, there are also Birth to Three, Early Head Start, Right from the Start.
So I have a personal experience with this, Rick. Actually, the Birth to Three people came into my home when my son was diagnosed with autism before his second birthday, and were the very first people to help him get on the path to the success he's having today.
I know a couple other people you might not think, you know, highly successful, you know, middle-class families, and they both their kids had some issues, and Birth to Three stepped in and really helped. So,
who are the home visitors? What are they like, and what do they do?
Home visitors are often, in most cases, people from the community that they work in, and they might actually be a parent who receives services in their home, or they might be a social worker or a nurse.
So I have a conversion experience to relate on this issue. You know, I've been around these social service providers for years and years, and I heard people talk about home visiting, early childhood education. I would, you know, snooze until I had this experience where I was like Saul of Tarsus, got blinded by the light on the road to Damascus. And part of it was I learned about the Romanian orphan story. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but Ceausescu was the Stalinist dictator of Romania, and he was even whacked by Stalinist standards. And he forbade any kind of birth control. He actually had people inspect women of childbearing age every so often to make sure there was nothing going on, because he wanted lots of babies for his utopia. And that collapsed, and there are these tons of orphans in Romanian orphanages, and many of them just didn't receive a lot of care. They were just kind of left. And what they did eventually, they started fostering them out. And the thing I thought was really striking is the ones who were sent to a loving foster home before they were 2 years of age could recover cognitively, emotionally, socially, and the ones who didn't. You know, it's really stark, and it seems like there is a window that starts like from conception to about age two, where if things don't happen, then they don't happen at all. And that's what really caught my attention, and then I dug into it some more and became a believer.
This movement has been around for, I don't know, almost three decades. And yet in West Virginia, it's not ubiquitous, right? It's not available to all families who need it, whereas there are states like Missouri, for example, where Parents as Teachers is just about everywhere. Where does the money come from?
There's $1 million in state funding and millions of dollars in federal funding that come through the state DHHR.
Rick, I mean, what's your take on it? Why don't we have, if this is so effective, we spend so much money dealing with the consequences of kids who have special needs, or kids who have substance abuse problems, or kids who end up in the juvenile justice system. Why do we spend only $1 million on preventing all that from happening?
Well, I think it's a question of priorities. Now, to his credit, Governor Tomlin had a task force that was really looking at this and trying to come up with a long-range plan. And I was thinking there might be a real window to take it to another level, but that at this point, that window, that would be an understatement, right?
Yeah, that hasn't happened like we thought it would. The Early Childhood Planning Task Force did do a lot of work, a lot of research, and gathered a lot of great people around the table to talk about early childhood issues. And home visiting was a big, I think it was their number one priority in their list of priorities. And that hasn't happened. We do enjoy continued support from the state.
Does this, Michelle, support come from both sides of the aisle? Do you have Republicans and Democrats who support this program?
Yes, we are fortunate to have bipartisan support of this issue.
In fact, some of the states that have really gone all out on this are fairly conservative, like Oklahoma, I think, is one, and several others you might not think of, I mean, that aren't exactly like Seattle or Vermont, you know, that have You know, because it is, if you're conservative, you want to get the biggest bang from your buck financially. That's a good way to do it.
Yes.
But there's two goals that I think that would be nice to get to. And I think you're going to talk about this, Michelle. One is it would be nice if there was universal access to voluntary home visiting, like from the time someone found out they were pregnant to the first couple years. And then there's this huge marketing piece that needs to happen so that the people don't think of it as something for those people or for poor people or whatever. Now, some programs really are targeted to certain populations, but the goal, I think, would be anyone who wants it can have it, not forcing it on anybody. But again, that would take a huge marketing effort, like from hospitals and doctors, pediatricians, libraries, whatever, to really make this just part of the culture.
Well, and how much of it is an issue of convincing parents, for example, to allow home visitors into their home? I know we have home visitors come and have since Max was diagnosed. The kitchen sink is full of dirty dishes. It's so hard to open your home to people that you don't know well, especially if you might be low income and you're worried that are they here to judge you. So how do home visiting programs deal with that problem?
It is a significant problem, Scott. And we just try to, like you mentioned, it's people working in their community. So hopefully they know these people, the visitors. And we, through word of mouth, we want to emphasize that the home visitors are there to support the family and to not judge them. They work from a strengths-based perspective. And although they are mandated reporters, they're not called in by CPS and they're not CPS. They go in with a family and try to work with them. You had touched on it earlier, and I wanted to emphasize that parents are their children's first teachers. And
I remember when my kids were little, like, oh my God, what do? You know, it's a real thing where I think a lot of people could really use some help because we don't really have all the instinctual things going on. It's something you got to figure out and improvise as you go.
Right. And we don't always have a support system around us to help us. And sometimes that support system maybe doesn't have the right information. Part of the program's appeal to me is that there's recent research informing the work. So we know things that we didn't know when any of us were children.
There's been some longitudinal studies. This program they don't have in West Virginia, but the Nurse Family Partnership, but they studied like, you know, years and years out from this. And what they found is like people who participate in this program, like the mothers, are more likely to maintain a stable relationship with employment, less likely to get arrested, more likely to be in touch with the birth father, not to mention all these other things.
These longitudinal studies, I'm familiar with some of them too, are interesting because a lot of times if you measure things like academic performance, you don't necessarily see the effect. But what you see is these sort of like longer term goals of basically a happy and healthy life. But you have to stick with it for a long time to see those results.
So one thing we haven't discussed is the elephant in the room. Michelle and I are Netflix buddies and we exchange information on what's vital to watch. So any good ones these days that I need to pay attention to?
Well, I'm still, you know, we're still basking in the afterglow of the first two seasons of The Bridge.
Like,
and
that's
I
like
need
the
you
Scandinavian
to go. Yeah, the yeah. Scandinavian crime drama.
I'm glad my wife doesn't listen to this podcast because, like, one of the female police officers on there is named Sega, and I kind of have a crush on her. So we have a big audience in Scandinavia, Scott,
huge.
Right? Okay,
huge.
I'm hoping this will do pave the way. All right.
So what is it about crime dramas from places that have very little crime?
I know it kind of stands out.
Well,
right?
They have time to be really good at their job. I think they're not overwhelmed and they're just real thorough. And Sega gets in there and she's looking for the clues and figures it out.
Looking. I mean, she's also like on the autism spectrum, so you might find that character interesting.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But wow, you know. So.
All right, we're going to have to get a picture. We'll put a picture on our website, go to wvpublic.org, which is also where you can find more information about the Partners in Community Outreach and other home visiting programs in West Virginia. Michelle Baranaskis, Coordinator of Partners in Community Outreach, thanks for coming on the Front Porch.
You're welcome. Thank you.